we get our ideas about aliens and potential alien life from Hollywood. We get it from popular entertainment, from TV, sometimes from music, I guess, from comic books, but especially cinema, and especially Hollywood cinema.
Ladies and gentlemen, we know!
It seems that, you know, audiences really stand very little chance now against this alien invasion of our popular culture. It's an overlooked area, Hollywood's representations of UFOs. I think most people kind of push it to the sidelines in the field of UFO research because it is seen as a bit trivial. But actually, I think that people really need to start looking at it much, much more closely, because as the world changes with regard to UFOs, we can look to Hollywood's representations over the years and really probably pick apart how our expectations and perceptions have been formed, and then in turn hopefully gain a greater understanding of what we're actually presented with. That's what they're doing. I'm convinced of it, and it's happening around the world, and it's happening everywhere but America, because they can't do it, because they're in this really bad situation. I mean, to be honest, what I've just said to you is as explicit and bold as I've ever been on this subject.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 7. I cannot believe it has been almost a month since you last heard from me, folks. I apologize heartily for that. Just a slew of off-site work fell into my lap unexpectedly since the last edition of the program, so I had to kind of put BOA on the back burner while I took care of business. Trust me, in the long run, it is what has to be done to keep the entire BOA franchise going into the distant future. With all that said, let's get cooking on this edition of the program. We are going to examine the connection between Hollywood, UFOs, and the government with our guest doctoral candidate Robbie Graham, creator of the critically acclaimed and massively popular website Silver Screen Saucers. Over the course of our conversation, we are going to discuss how Hollywood shapes the public perception and expectations of the UFO phenomenon and ETs. We'll learn how pervasive Robbie feels the government's intervention is in UFO entertainment, and we'll hear about how the DOD and the CIA work with filmmakers and Hollywood studios to advance differing agendas. Plus, we'll talk about the rise in UFO films in the last decade and ponder what that might mean for the population's mindset regarding the phenomenon and whether it's part of a larger campaign to prepare us for eventual first contact. In total, it is an engrossing conversation which peels at the layers of our collective constructed reality and peers into the abyss of the UFO enigma with a profound student of the phenomenon, Robbie Graham. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Robbie Graham, please allow me to provide you with a little background on him. Robbie Graham is a doctoral candidate at the University of Bristol for a PhD examining Hollywood's historical representations of UFOs and potential extraterrestrial life. As a freelance writer and lecturer, his work emphasizes the industrial, cultural, and political processes by which Hollywood's UFO movie content is shaped, as well as the impact of these movies on popular perceptions of the UFO phenomenon. He holds a master's degree with distinction in cinema studies from the University of Bristol and a first-class honors degree in film, television, and radio studies from Staffordshire University. He has appeared on BBC Radio, Coast to Coast AM, and Canal Plus TV. Additionally, his articles have appeared in a variety of publications, including The Guardian, New Statesman, Film Facts, Fortean Times, Adbusters, and the peer-reviewed Journal of North American Studies, 49th Parallel. His website is www.silverscreensaucers.com. Pretty simple, all one word, silverscreensaucers.com. Check it out. Before I unleash this episode on you, want to give you just a quick heads up that we had another Skype issue with this episode. Robbie Graham was on Skype during the first 10 minutes of the show, but was breaking up quite a bit, so I switched him over to a landline as expeditiously as possible. So if you're tuning in and you're finding yourself frustrated with the connection at the very beginning, just sit tight because we get it all straightened out within the first 10 minutes of the conversation. With all that said, let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on July 12, 2012, Robbie Graham, talking about the Hollywood UFO connection on BOA Audio, Season 7. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio, Season 7. This time on the program, it's going to be one fascinating conversation for you folks. I am really looking forward to it. As many of the longtime listeners know, I'm kind of jaded about UFOs, but I've kind of still have an interest in some of the more interesting subsections, if you will, subsets, genres. And our guest really has carved out an amazing niche in that regard. He's the man behind Silver Screen Saucers, the very popular website, and he's also writing a book based on his work at Silver Screen Saucers. And he's also a doctoral candidate at the University of Bristol, which is tremendous because, you know, you're a young guy and you're pursuing this and you're about to become a doctor. We need more people like you. We need more people in intelligentsia to get behind this. So it's exciting in that regard as well. He is, of course, Robbie Graham, coming to us direct from the UK. Robbie, welcome to BOA Audio.
Thanks, Tim. Great to be here.
Now, we usually start out with the bio, the background. You know, who is Robbie Graham? I kind of teased some of that here in the introduction. But, you know, tell us more about you, where you came from, and, you know, how you got an interest in the UFO subject.
I suppose I've been interested in UFOs since my teens, since I was about 14. I've always been interested in weird and wonderful subjects, but I suppose I just got sucked into the UFO thing in the mid-90s, just as it was starting to explode into popular culture in a big way, with the X-Files, of course, and the plethora of movies that were released by Hollywood during the mid to late 90s, and I became very interested, and I bought all the books, and Timothy Good, Nick Redfern, and all of the American authors as well.
Yeah.
And as a teenager, you don't really know how to make sense of it, how to comprehend it, but it sure is fascinating, and ultimately becomes quite frustrating because you think, well, what the hell can I do about it? Not a lot.
Yeah.
Especially when you're 15, 16 years old. So I kind of lost interest I didn't lose interest, but I kind of got frustrated with it and life got in the way. And
exactly.
I carried on with school and went to college and university. But actually when I was in college, about 17, 18 years old, my grandparents, who lived very close to me, to where I used to live with my parents, they saw, they told me after the fact that they had spent 2 hours watching three brightly lit disc-shaped objects performing all sorts of fantastical aerial maneuvers, over a field probably half a mile behind where I lived.
Oh, wow.
they were looking at it from that, looking at this display, from their window, sort of past my family's house. So had they called me and said, "Robbie, look out the window," I would have probably seen what they'd have witnessed. But for some bizarre reason, they didn't. And I learned of this after the fact, and I was just completely gutted that they hadn't contacted me. But they had never had any interest at all in UFOs, no knowledge of the subject. So this really captured my imagination again. And I spent a long time talking to them about it. I kind of wrote a report just for my own, for my own reference based on what they'd said. And my granddad, who is no longer with us, he told me that this was the most amazing thing he'd ever witnessed in his entire life. And that was coming from someone who, lived through World War II and fought, you know, and he'd seen some amazing things in his life, and he said that this was just absolutely out of, well, literally out of this world. And so I just thought, gosh, and so I kind of got stuck back into it. So I started to do research again, read all the new books, and anyway, it was at this point that I really started to become obsessed with film more generally, and I started to pursue it academically. And I did a couple of film studies degrees at university. And then the UFO interest never really died away, and so the film and the UFOs naturally merged as the two obsessions of my life. and so it seemed only natural that I start to apply film, film studies to the UFO subject and vice versa. And so, that's where the PhD has come from, and that's what I'm currently working on right now.
Yeah, that's really interesting in a sense, because I would be concerned, I guess, I don't know, here in America, to pursue my PhD with any sort of connection to UFOs. Is there any sort of blowback on that, or it seems like they're letting you go ahead with it, but, you know, what's the reaction of others in the collegial sphere?
Well, you know, I was very shocked when they accepted my proposal, to be honest. I didn't think that it would get through, just because, you know, as you point out, historically academia has been it's wanted nothing to do with the UFO subject, really. And so I to a certain extent, I had to kind of dress up my proposal in a lot of cultural and film history, and extraordinarily objective to the point of debunkery about the subject in order to actually get it in and have it accepted. But at the same time, I've slowly started to speak with my supervisors. I've got two supervisors because my PhD is actually split between two departments, because it's a cross-departmental, PhD, because it deals with both cultural studies and film studies, which are distinct areas, in academia. And, so that's made it slightly more difficult as well, because I'm having to justify my work to not one supervisor, but to two. But it's going well, and they are not enormously resistant to my ideas. I'm managing to get it down. I'm getting it. The PhDs, they take a long time. I'm currently on a requested 12-month leave from the university, because I'm currently writing up a first version of the PhD, which will be my book, Silver Screen Sources, Sorting Facts from Fantasy in Hollywood's UFO Movies, and that, as I say, will be a populist version of the PhD. I want to get that done ASAP.
I found it interesting. I noticed when you were doing the background in your bio there that you must be about the same age as me, because I was a teenager during the 90s as well. So you must be like in your early 30s or so?
I'm 31.
All right. You're younger than me. Wow. I should have gone and got my doctorate, man. Look, what did I wasted all this time. So, all right.
I wouldn't recommend it. It's not the most fun thing in the world, I have to say.
We had some breakage there. I figure and assume I'll be able to clean most of it up. But for the people, if we don't get an exact, cleanup on that, what you were saying is that this PhD had to get approved by two different people in the university, and kind of had to slant it a little bit in the, I guess, negative way towards UFOs. And can that change over time? Are they open to that evolving, or are you under pressure now to tell it how he told them you were going to tell it, if you will?
I do have a certain amount of freedom to kind of work it the way I want it. Ultimately, it's my project, and I will ultimately write what I want to write, but that doesn't mean that at the end of the day they're going to approve what I write. However, whatever I write is not to be declaring the reality of extraterrestrial visitation by any means. It will be extraordinarily skeptical, but without being a debunking piece. It will be extremely objective, shall we say, as it should be. Yes, I've got a certain amount of freedom with what I can write. I am being supported by my supervisors, but it's just a struggle to communicate to them the nuances of the subject, because they have absolutely no grounding in it whatsoever, which is not surprising. So it is a bit of a struggle, but then, you know, anyone doing a PhD has a difficult time because it's not an easy thing to do. You're under an immense amount of scrutiny. You have to justify everything you do, every statement you make, every piece of work you submit. And it's a long, drawn-out process. So, as I say, I'm currently on a one-year requested leave from the PhD, which is going to prolong the process even further because I asked to take a year off in order to be able to write up a populist version of the PhD into the book that I'm working on, the Silver Screen Exhausted book, which I hope to have completed by spring of next year.
Now, did I hear you say that? Now, because you broke up a little bit on me there, and I was gonna—it was right at the interesting part. I thought it's okay. That this thesis is going to be skeptical without being a debunking piece. So I guess tell me more about that because I find that interesting. Is this a conclusion you've come to, and skeptical about what?
It's not saying skeptical. I'd say it's extremely objective, which as it should be. You know,
yeah.
It's a piece of academic work, and it's not making it's not speculative. In the slightest, everything I say has to be backed up with very solid facts from reputable sources. But it's not so much about taking a stance on the reality, on the nature, shall we say, of the UFO phenomenon, although ultimately that comes through. Someone reading the thesis would ultimately get the impression that I do put a lot of credence in the idea that UFOs are of non-human origin. That will come through in the PhD. There's a lot of evidence that I present to back that up as well. So, but it's not about UFOs per se, it's about Hollywood's representations
right.
of the UFO phenomenon and the idea of extraterrestrial life. So it's looking at how Hollywood shapes our perceptions and expectations of potential extraterrestrial visitation, of first contact. The UFO phenomenon and how that might be tied in with this idea. So those are the ideas it explores, and it adopts cultural and film studies approaches.
So will the PhD then also tie in the government part of this whole Hollywood influence, or is it just a strict telling of the Hollywood portrayal of UFOs without getting into sort of the more I guess you could call it conspiratorial angles?
That's how I term it. As I say, what the PhD will do and what the book will do is tell the story of UFOs, of the public's interest in the phenomenon and of the government's interest in the phenomenon. It will tell that story through film, through Hollywood's representations of the phenomenon and through Hollywood's depictions of potential extraterrestrial life, because pretty much over the years is what you've had is all aspects of ufology being represented on screen, because what Hollywood does, I've found, is it's parasitic towards ufology.
Yeah.
It sucks on the veins of ufology because it uses all of these very rich ideas in UFO literature, UFO debate from online, from the wealth of literature that's been written over the years, and it uses all of that, incorporates it into its own fictional narratives, and it spins it. And it makes for great entertainment. But what that does in the process is it simultaneously fictionalizes the subject, because we automatically then associate these ideas, which many of which have a grounding in historical reality, in our lived historical reality, and many of which are, shall we say, factual.
Yeah.
It takes these ideas and it presents them in a fictional context, especially a fantastical context, in the context of a sci-fi film. And when it does that, it fictionalizes these ideas. Now, you could look at that as a natural cultural process, that it's simply something that Hollywood scriptwriters do because it's logical to do, because Hollywood likes to mine great ideas wherever they arise.
Yeah.
Or you could look at it from the more conspiratorial angle and suggest, well, is there a game here? Is there an agenda? Are intelligence agencies, government operatives, deliberately confusing people through Hollywood, deliberately sowing disinformation, misinformation, or propagandizing in terms of fear mongering, or projecting other ideas that are beneficial to the state? Is that going on? So I do look at both of those ideas in the PhD and in the book. What I kind of lean towards is the idea that, for the most part, what we're seeing is a natural cultural phenomenon. Hollywood, you know, of course, is open to manipulation by government agencies, especially by the CIA and Department of Defense. And certainly, over the years, both of those organizations and other organizations have tweaked UFO-themed scripts, and they've censored them, they've seeded them, but this is only in a limited way. You can point to a number of productions over the years where you can say, yes, absolutely, we know, as a matter of fact, that that has occurred, and I've documented that in various articles, and others have documented it also. But is it really that pervasive? Is it something where, you know, every single UFO movie that comes out has been tampered with by the elite? And the answer is no. It's just not the case.
Yeah.
What we are having what we're seeing is a natural cultural process. But that's no less interesting, really. And ultimately, the effect on our perceptions is the same, regardless of who's tampering or how it's being tampered with or how it's being affected, whether it's natural or conspiratorial. Ultimately, these films have the same effect on our perceptions of the phenomenon, and they serve to confuse us. As I say, they serve to fictionalize the phenomenon through its association with spectacular entertainment, fantastical entertainment. But at the same time, ironically, they actually serve to actualize the phenomenon as well, because Hollywood really does have this unique power over us. Film generally has this mystical power where it seems to actualize the imaginings of, you know, of screenwriters and creatives, whether in Hollywood or Bollywood or Britain or any other film industry in the world. It takes ideas, and through their projection, through this you know, very simple medium, ultimately, which is goes back to the late 1900s. For me, cinema really is, and this is one of my main focuses in my work. I really do think that cinema is a uniquely powerful medium, and I think that even in today's world, you know, of iPads and TV on demand, cinema really does remain this wondrous, and as I say, almost magical, mystical medium. And I think that it does remain so popular because what cinema offers to us that our PCs and our Macs and our tablet devices and, you know, even our TVs don't, is this an expansive, you know, communal experience. Is this an opportunity, really, to gather in a public space with dozens, sometimes hundreds of other people, human beings, all of whom are essentially strangers to one another, but who, for 90 minutes at least, are united, really, on an emotional journey. And I think there is something undeniably special about that, about sitting in a darkened cinema and being able to hear a pin drop as the action unfolds around you. In the work that I'm writing, I quote the late great British filmmaker Ken Russell, and he once said that Hollywood fills the gaps in our knowledge of the world, and I think that's absolutely true, and I think that also that's pretty scary for obvious reasons. We take our cues for reality from Hollywood.
Yeah.
It has this very strange effect on us. And I think that that's also incentive for us to pay much closer attention to precisely what it is that Hollywood is telling us, especially when it comes to a subject like UFOs. Because, you know, we have to look at where we get our ideas from about UFOs and potential extraterrestrial life. Are scientists regularly holding conferences that are broadcast, you know, to the world? No. I mean, they do hold conferences, obviously, but they're very insular, they're closed off, they're usually just aimed at an academic, strictly scientific audience, and occasionally there'll be brief details of those meetings and conferences reported in the media. But essentially, we don't have access to that. We get our ideas about aliens and potential alien life from Hollywood. We get it from popular entertainment, from TV, sometimes from music, I guess, from comic books, but especially cinema, and especially Hollywood cinema. So, you know, if we were to... And again, you know, it makes sense because UFOs are naturally cinematic. You know, these sleek, unearthly objects, they perform remarkable aerial maneuvers, they, you know, they shimmer, they glow, they glide. And so, although they're factual, although they're based in our lived historical reality, UFOs are also the stuff of great science fiction.
Absolutely, yeah. It's
unsurprising that they've always sold very well at the box office. But what I find fascinating and why I think it's so important to be looking at this subject right now is because in the last 10 years, we've seen this huge explosion in the popularity of the UFO subgenre. I've counted at least 40 UFO movies that meet my criteria of a UFO movie, and I'll go into that in a minute. They've been produced since the year 2000. You've had the likes of, you know, Signs, War of the Worlds, Transformers trilogy, Indiana Jones, Crystal Skull, you know, Monsters vs. Aliens, The Fourth Kind, Battle Los Angeles, Cowboys and Aliens, Super 8, Prometheus, to name but a few, as I say. You know, add to that TV series like The Event, Falling Skies, and you've got a new TV series coming out probably early next year called Area 51. And so it seems that, you know, audiences really stand very little chance now against this alien invasion of our popular culture.
I was just thinking that the very expression, yeah.
Right, so, you know, but most people might say, well, so what? Why should we care about UFO movies? You know, they're just entertainment, aren't they? Well, yes and no. UFO movies do matter, you know, especially if we consider the possibility that we may one day live in what Bryce Zabel and Richard Dolan refer to as an after-disclosure world or a post-disclosure world, whatever form disclosure takes, you know, whatever these UFOs turn out to be. There is obviously something to hide, something is being hidden, and there is information to be released. And I think it's probably fair to say that at some point we will have more access to that information. Now, one of the first things people will want to know after disclosure, post-disclosure, is why these, for argument's sake, call them extraterrestrials, why these ETs are here. To issue us with a warning and an ultimatum, like in the day the Earth stood still, you know, to raise our cosmic awareness and to, you know, welcome us into their galactic community, like in Spielberg's Close Encounters. You know, or are they here to, you know, to annihilate us and strip mine the Earth for its resources, like in Emmerich's Independence Day? You know, well, we'd also probably wonder what these beings look like. You know, and naturally, one of the first things that pop into mind to our minds are, cinematic iconography.
Right, right.
You're going to find it very hard to separate the reality that we're presented with from our cinematic memories, because that's all we've had. You know, that's the only input really we've had about aliens is cinema.
You know, right. It's like if God showed up, everyone would have a different opinion on what he's supposed to look like.
Well, we all know what God looks like. He looks like a man with a white beard and so because that's what pop culture tells us. And obviously, you know, God has been rendered that way in artwork going back centuries. But
right, it's like the grey alien in a sense.
Right, precisely. But at the same time, is that there's all arguments about the iconography of greys, but we'd wonder what these beings look like. If this thing's piloting these crafts, then my God, why are they here? What do they look like? Do they look like Predator? Do they look like E.T.? Are they friendly? You know, are they little intergalactic gardeners? You know, maybe they're robots, like, you know, the Transformers. I mean, they can disguise themselves as earthly technology.
Yeah.
You know, or maybe they're little green men, like in Invasion of the Saucer Men, or Aliens in the Attic, or Planet 51, or the Toy Story movies. You know, we might just think, oh my God, let's hope they're not these insectoid child snatchers of Falling Skies on TV right now. The point is is this good or bad? You know, well, it depends on whether or not Hollywood's historical depictions of UFO occupants really bear any relation to the true nature and intent of the ETs or the UFO occupants themselves. And I think it goes without saying that most of Hollywood's aliens are, shall we say, not the friendliest of folk. Most of them want really only to enslave, to eat or otherwise eradicate humanity. And but for a handful of exceptions, Hollywood's aliens are these malevolent, physically monstrous creatures. And their level of technological advancement really does outstrip their moral and spiritual and ethical advancement.
Now, yeah.
Is this realistic? Well, I'm not quite so sure that it is. I know that a lot of people would argue with me on that, but I don't think that's necessarily realistic, or at least it's a very myopic perspective, shall we say. Overwhelmingly, Hollywood's aliens are monstrous and invasive, and I think that's a shame. As human beings, we are imbued with this natural fear of the unknown. And obviously, you know, in a post-disclosure world, Hollywood's hordes of fearsome aliens won't really do much to calm those nerves.
That's for sure. Let me jump in here, because you've said a bunch of stuff here, and I had one point that I wanted to mention here, but then you said a whole bunch of other interesting things, and I was so I was like, wait, now I want to ask him about something else. So, but let me just jump back here. It's really tremendously refreshing to hear you sort of downplay the government involvement in Hollywood in a sense, because given the field of ufology, it's prone to overreaction. So it was refreshing to hear you say that, you know, yes, it happens, but it's not like this all-encompassing thing where the government's controlling every UFO movie that comes out, which, thank you, I guess.
They're absolutely not controlling every UFO movie. They certainly take an interest. When I say they, I don't mean the government, but elements within the government, elements within certain organizations, CIA, DOD, certainly do take an active interest in Hollywood's depictions of UFOs. For obvious reasons, they've always been interested in how the media represents the subject. So we can talk about examples later on about, you know, for example, the Department of Defense's involvement in Transformers, or the CIA's involvement in Race to Witch Mountain, or the CIA's influence in the Cold War on various films, genre pictures, not just UFO movies, but others. And so there is tweaking that has gone on. There is seeding of information, censoring in some cases. So obviously, the CIA, the DOD do take a very keen interest in how this subject is portrayed, not only in the news media, but also in entertainment media. But their powers are limited. You know, they can't go out and actively influence every UFO movie that comes out of Hollywood. It just can't be done. It's not how the system works. And anyone who says that can be done has no idea about how Hollywood actually works. So yes, it happens, and it has happened demonstrably in quite a number of cases, but it's not all pervasive. Overwhelmingly, we are talking about a natural cultural process.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And you wonder if there's always sort of this old idea that, you know, that the government's influencing this long-term acclimation process, and that may be the case in a very skeletal way, I guess you could say, a very sort of like,
yeah,
they just push the ball down the hill.
I think that's a good way of phrasing it, actually. Yeah, again, there are some very strong cases that suggest that elements within the government, the military, have attempted to test the waters, shall we say, in terms of public reaction to the idea of alien contact. And there are some films that support that, some case studies that support that. We can go into those later. I mean, we've got, you know, Robert Emmenegger case of the early 70s, and a number of other films from the 50s as well, that support that idea. So there have been attempts, but they are isolated and scattered throughout the last 60 years. There's not a continuous effort that's going on.
That sort of leads you to think, on a human level, if it's, like you say, it's a cultural thing, maybe we're acclimating ourselves, if you will, to this whole UFO thing. Do you know what I mean? It's like the government isn't pulling the strings necessarily. We're sort of waking up and getting acclimated ourselves to this whole thing.
I think that's, again, another very, very good observation. I think that people, it's very ironic that, you know, people in the conspiracy community, and especially in the UFO community, have for years been extraordinarily critical of the government and of establishment power structures with regard to secrecy surrounding this phenomenon. And we grant the government this omnipotence, this godlike power. But actually, you know, I think there's a strong argument to be made that the government, obviously they know more than we do about certain aspects of the subject, but not all, about certain aspects of it. But I think ultimately they're as clueless as we are. And I do think that to an extent there's a cover-up of ignorance. But I think that we all need to just take a step back and say, look, government, you do what you want to do. We're going to do what we want to do. We're going to educate ourselves about this. We don't need you to disclose the information. We already know. We can look at you know, 60 years worth of case studies, of reports, of witness testimonies, and we can start to piece together the puzzle, the puzzle for ourselves. We don't need you to spoon feed it to us. And, you know, even if you were to give it to us and disclose all of this stuff en masse, why should we believe you anyway? You know, because you've been disinforming us and concealing it from us for 60 years. So why on earth would you, you know, in the event of disclosure, why on earth would what you tell us be true, or at least be completely true? And the answer is, of course, it wouldn't. And so we need to exercise caution there about, you know, just begging for disclosure and begging for the government to tell us what it knows, because ultimately, I think we know as much as they do in certain respects, not in every respect, but in certain respects, we know probably more.
It would be interesting, and maybe you know this, because you talk about the films shaping our reality, and I and also the explosion of UFO films in the last 10 years. It would be interesting to see the preponderance of disclosure scenarios that play out in these movies. Has it increased or decreased? Like I said, maybe you might know that, or maybe you could speak to that, because it makes me think that there is like this long-term narrative, and maybe that this disclosure thing is sort of like the next turn in all this, and that you're seeing that maybe in the movies, or maybe you're not. That's kind of what I'm asking here. What do you think?
Were you asking if the disclosure scenario is playing out in the movies, whether or not Hollywood has started to incorporate the ideas of disclosure?
Right. Is it playing out more than it used to, or, you know, I'm sure you can go back to the 50s where there's like a movie where the president says UFOs, you know, maybe there isn't. I don't know. That's, I guess, because I mean, if you think about it, you know, like Independence Day, there's the big scene where he's like, where he announces that the aliens are here and everything. You wonder if...
Well, right, but don't forget, of course, in Independence Day, the aliens, and that, the announcement...
He already showed up.
Is redundant anyway,
yeah.
Because for everyone's cities.
That's true.
So it's a forced disclosure, which is an interesting scenario in itself, and there could be a huge discussion around that. You know, some people suggest that the only way disclosure is going to come about is through a forced, you know, disclosure. It will have to be a forced disclosure. The government's hand will be forced into revealing information about this subject because they have no other choice but to do so. So that's interesting from that perspective. Now, in terms of Hollywood kind of really getting on board the disclosure bandwagon, not in a big way. However, you can look at, of course, the TV series that came out last year, which was called The Event, which was cancelled after one series. And, of course, that very heavily tapped into UFO literature and debate, into internet memes surrounding disclosure. And it really, it just mined that completely.
Yeah.
And it caused huge debate in the UFO conspiracy community, the event, and everyone saying, oh, this is clearly a step towards disclosure. It could be, but there's no reason to suggest that it's actually not just writers who have got their finger on the pulse and who are saying, well, this is great ideas, this makes for great drama, let's do a series about it. You know, all the information's out there on the internet. We don't need to have special access to classified information. We can just go and look at Project Camelot and get a bunch of really crazy, you know, ultra-exciting conspiratorial ideas and just weave them into this great narrative for a TV series.
Right.
You know, that would be the most logical assumption. I'm not saying that that's definitely what happened, but, you know, that would be a logical assumption. So I think that's an example of how this cultural process plays out. But no, what I find interesting, and one of the things I'm looking at in my doctoral research is how Hollywood adopts certain aspects of the subject and really goes to town with them, and it completely sidelines other aspects of the subject. To the point that they're just completely ignored. So, for example, aliens in Hollywood movies are always, well, as I say, they're almost always monstrous creatures. Often, when they're not overtly kind of monstrous, multiple-limbed, you know, creatures, they are the greys.
Right.
And the greys are always in these films portrayed as either indifferent to humanity or overtly hostile. And what you almost never see, but for about three or maybe four examples over the last 60 years, is any depictions of the human-type beings that people consistently report and have consistently reported since the 50s, these so-called Nordic beings are almost completely absent from Hollywood's representations of UFOs and extraterrestrials, as well as the other different types of beings that have been reported, these sort of light beings and other slightly more amorphous beings. None of those really feature heavily in Hollywood's narratives, and that could simply be because, well, you know, it's, the writers might think, well, everyone knows what an alien looks like, and they don't look like us. Therefore, it must have, you know, so, let's not do a film about Nordic human-looking aliens. You know, and this is the same thing, you know, with the Hollywood adaptation of Travis Walton's Fire in the Sky story, where, of course, famously, Travis reported seeing not only these grey-type beings, but also in the same craft, presumably, or at least in the same experience, these Nordic beings, classic Nordic beings. And, of course, in the film, you only had these kind of monstrous, shriveled, little goblin things that, that basically just tortured him. There was no reference there to these human beings. And, you know, and you can see why that kind of decision might be made, from a creative perspective, because, you know, how do you, if you as an audience are not versed in ufology, it's going to be kind of baffling from a generic perspective.
Yeah.
All of a sudden throw in humans with greys, because in popular entertainment, that's just not done. That's not what we expect to see. And so it would be quite a radical move for them to do it, even if it has been reported.
Right. So to just to sort of make the story cleaner, if you will, for the audience, more palatable, because they're just going to be, they'll just, you know, it'll be distracting to them, in a sense. Yeah.
That's precisely it. But the other thing that Hollywood has completely sidelined, or perhaps that's unfair, perhaps it's yet to embrace it or to look at it in any way, is this idea of exopolitics. I've never heard the term exopolitics used in any Hollywood entertainment product, film or TV, despite the fact that exopolitics has had a huge influence on literature and debate in ufology over the last, at least 5-6 years, probably longer, since the new millennium, really.
Yeah, it's been like a decade-long phenomenon.
Right,
yeah.
But they've yet to catch on to it. They've yet to kind of use it as a narrative device in any kind of way, whether in a derogatory fashion or you know, embracing it. They've just not really had any comment on it at all. And again, it's not surprising because probably doesn't make for very good entertainment.
Right. You'd have to do a Law and Order type show.
Right. So, I'm not saying it couldn't be done. It could be done. It would have to be a very sophisticated show, and you'd have to have some serious talent behind it. But it could be a great show, in fact. But you know, you'd be looking at having a show like The Wire with exopolitics, or you know, that level of sophistication.
Right.
But what most people prefer, or you know, what writers prefer to do with UFOs, is stick to firmly established and generic conventions. Everyone knows in Hollywood, when you write a UFO film, you write your characters as being either, you know, geeks who drive around in Winnebagos, which are kitted out with anti-government spyware technology, and they wear tinfoil hats, and they sleep, you know, and they live with their mums in the basement, and that's the UFO geek, and that's what Hollywood likes, because, you know, again, it's all about stereotypes, and that's how entertainment works. Exopolitics doesn't really fit the mold, and it's kind of dull. It's not particularly effective. I hate to say that. I'm not saying it can't be, but at the moment, it's not particularly effective. It consists of forming and signing petitions, which no one really pays any attention to.
Right. It's like a model UN.
Right.
It's like when the adults decide to get involved, all the people in exopolitics, which is the model UN, are just going to get pushed out anyway.
It's a shame, maybe it's not a shame, but, you know.
Yeah, that's debatable.
but you're right. No, I think that's exactly what will happen.
I feel like the preponderance of bad aliens just speaks a lot to the culture anyway, that you have to have an enemy in a sense. And with the Cold War over and terrorism being too real for people, the world's a smaller place, so you have to invent an enemy, almost.
Well, Hollywood loves its bad guys. You know, aliens have always been the ideal bad guys, especially, you know, since the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991. you know, that signaled the formal end to the Cold War. Hollywood has really struggled to find its new enemy nation, you know, its new bad guy,
yeah.
a guy who it can vilify and demonize without fear of political or religious consequences. And whose role is this, you know, malevolent, subversive invader can't really be questioned. Well, you know, in the absence of that, Hollywood has always fallen back on aliens, on the extraterrestrial menace. And, you know, from The Thing from Another World in 1951 to, you know, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, The Fourth Kind, Battleship, you know, trust the aliens and their, you know, their dastardly ways. And all of that is perfectly fine, of course, because officially aliens don't exist. And therefore you can't offend them. So you can't stir up hatred towards them. You know, you're not worried about political reprisal from aliens because technically they don't exist. So it's not like you can, you know, you're not worried about offend, you know, whereas, you know, episodes of cartoons can be censored because, you know, you fear offending Muslims. You know, you don't need to worry about that with aliens. You can portray them as however you want because technically they don't exist. But I wonder, again, in this hypothetical post-disclosure world, if the truth finally out, you know, Hollywood may well be faced with fresh accusations of racism and xenophobia. You know, will the industry attempt to redress, you know, its 60 years of alien bashing after disclosure, or will its demonization of these beings go into overdrive? I wonder. It's an interesting idea.
Right. Well, it'll be kind of disappointing in a sense, because once we know what the aliens look like, that'll eliminate all the other cool depictions of aliens.
Right. Well, exactly. What does Hollywood do then as an entertainment industry? I mean, assuming society doesn't completely fall to bits and Hollywood is a thing of the past, you know, assuming at some point films are going to continue to be made, how then do they depict extraterrestrials? Well, that's an interesting idea. Perhaps you'll get a new level of realism and naturalism and documentary style filmmaking where you have aliens portrayed as they actually are, as they actually appear, trying to explore their nature in a more direct way, and they'll become less fantastical perhaps, because obviously they're no longer science fiction, they're science fact. But perhaps I suspect even if that were the case, they might then invent new fictional aliens to explore other aspects of extraterrestrial society. And also, as you say, Hollywood always needs its bad guys. So if the ETs turn out to be as, you know, lovely as can be, then they'll still keep making films probably about evil aliens, because who's to say there aren't those out there too?
Yeah. Well, I don't think the human race will ever fully trust the aliens anyway, even if they were super nice. So I feel like it'll be always sort of a tense relationship.
Maybe, at least certainly for, I mean, it's absolutely crazy hypothetical scenarios here that we're discussing, but,
that's what we do here.
I would like to think that eventually the distrust would fade away, but I, obviously, if there were some kind of a disclosure scenario and it were, the earth-shattering kind that Hollywood depicts, or that we've speculated about in our UFO community, then obviously, society as we know it is pretty much gone. It just is. It will take a while to rebuild that, to reconnect the dots of our reality and to reassess our place in the universe. But I would like to think that at some point that a state of harmony could be reached.
I hope so, but I'd be weary of the aliens at first.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, I mean, it would be crazy not to be, I guess.
Yeah, and a lot of that probably is from the movies too, you know.
This is it. You know, I just wonder if we don't live in a cultural vacuum. You know, when we see in this hypothetical disclosure scenario, what does the first contact scenario look like? Well, most people, especially if you've grown up in the 50s, 60s. Most people would automatically call to mind the famous landing scene from The Day the Earth Stood Still of 1951, you know, where you have Klaatu and Gort exiting this classic flying saucer and wanting to speak to the United Nations. And that's the classic, take me to your leader, kind of a we come in peace scenario. And these ideas have become ingrained in the popular consciousness, and I think it's going to be impossible to divorce Hollywood's depictions of UFOs from the reality with which we're presented. And again, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, probably both. Not entirely bad, because most, you know, as I'm looking at in my research, a great deal of Hollywood's representations have been very closely informed by supposedly factual literature and debate, and so there may in fact be quite a bit of truth, ultimately, in Hollywood's collected science fiction UFO movies.
Yeah.
Obviously it's mixed with a great deal of fantasy and speculation, but ultimately there are kernels of truth in there, and so, you know, it shouldn't all necessarily be dismissed. Especially in films like Paul David's Roswell of 1994, and all sorts. I mean, Travis Walton's, of course, was essentially based on an allegedly true account, but was distorted. And there's been numerous others, Whitley Strieber's Communion film, and many, many others. But then, of course, you've got the absolutely outlandish propagandist products like Battleship, which came out last year, this year even, and you know, the Transformers movies, where they're just, well, on the surface of it, they're completely crazy. But again, the Transformers films are interesting because they were very closely supported by the Department of Defense and NASA and multiple other government branches, and their scripts were significantly shaped by the government. And they should, you know, rightfully be viewed as propagandist products, and they do put out a certain image, a certain concept of extraterrestrial contact, and they, you know, they absolve the government of complicity in an ongoing UFO cover-up. There's a very interesting scene in the first Transformers film from 2007, in which John Voight, who is playing the Secretary of Defense, learns for the first time that all of this alien hardware and bodies have been stored on ice for decades, and this is the first he's heard of it, because it's all been suppressed by a quasi-governmental group called Sector 7, which is clearly a nod to Majestic 12.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of the DOD putting its hands up and saying to audiences, look, it wasn't us, you know, we didn't know. Don't, so when the shit hits the fan, if I can say that.
That's fine.
When the crap hits the fan, you know, don't lynch us, because it was those guys. It was these guys who were acting above the law. It wasn't the Secretary of Defense. It wasn't the Department of Defense. We didn't know. And I think that's very interesting.
Now, was that inserted by them, or was that already in the script? Or I guess if they had, I guess there's sort of a tacit approval there, right, I guess?
The scripts are approved. The scripts, any film that has Department of Defense cooperation, the scripts are submitted to the Department of Defense constantly, and the DOD has its staff writers. They literally employ staff writers in Hollywood on the 12th floor of the Oppenheimer building on Wilshire Boulevard, which is where the government is based in Hollywood. And they have their staff writers, dozens of them from every branch of the government, writing scripts, censoring or highlighting lines, dialogue, saying, maybe change this to that, you know, it would be better to write it this way. How about this idea? Put that in there. And if you want their cooperation, if you want access to their battleships, their tanks and their troops and their advice, then you basically have to do what they say. And if you don't, then they withdraw their cooperation, and your film ends up costing a lot more, because you have to create everything from scratch in a computer, and it loses some of its realism.
That's interesting. And it seems, from some of the stuff I've read of your work, it's like, it seems as if it's less like they're trying to get involved in the UFO thing and more aimed at sort of portraying this image of military might and try and boost enrollment and that kind of stuff. It seems like they have a much different agenda than what people might think.
I think the UFO thing, you've got different levels of involvement as far as the UFO subject is concerned, I believe. When the Department of Defense is involved in films, whatever genre that film is, whether it's science fiction, thriller, drama, when the Department of Defense is involved in a film, its official mandate is to portray a positive image of the Department of Defense and of the military in order to boost recruitment and maintain retention of personnel. So it's kind of old school propaganda, and they're quite open about that. They don't really disguise that. Yeah. They don't call it propaganda. I mean, that's what it is, but they sort of say, you know, it's a PR exercise. They're about boosting recruitment, and that's what they want to do in Hollywood. As a peripheral thing, what happens is when the DoD gets involved in UFO movies, yes, first and foremost is what it's doing is it's trying to encourage recruitment and retention of personnel. But at the same time, obviously, you have to tread carefully when you're involved in a film about UFOs, given your history with the subject. The DoD, of course, has a very tangled history with UFOs. The Air Force closed its Project Blue Book in 1969, and officially that was the end of that, and the government has never been involved in UFO investigations since. So you have to be careful what kind of script you're endorsing as the Department of Defense. You know, are you going to work on a script, are you going to lend your support to a film that explicitly criticizes the military and explicitly depicts the military as being involved in a massive UFO cover-up? No, you're not. And if the film does contain those elements and you still want to lend your support to that film, then obviously you're going to suggest certain changes to the script. You're going to say, well, why don't you blame it on Sector 7 instead of the Department of Defense? Yeah. Why don't you have this guy involved instead, or why don't you blame it on that guy? And so that's the process. That's what happens with military involvement. But that's all of the overt, open, public involvement. Then you have the CIA, which operates in a far more mysterious way in Hollywood. And that goes back to the 50s. But I mean, what you have with the CIA is beginning in 1995, the CIA's Entertainment Liaison Office was set up. And this was the first time in its history that the CIA openly kind of, well, it came out of the shadows and stepped into Hollywood and said, look, we want to help filmmakers to more accurately portray what we do. That's how they phrase it.
Sounds very sinister, the whole thing.
Well, it is, frankly. I would say that, but it is. It is very sinister. And it's very misleading. So they have an open office, which is the Entertainment Liaison Office, and they liaise publicly, shall we say, loosely, use that term loosely, with filmmakers in order to encourage, again, exactly what the DoD wants to do, which is they try to boost recruitment for CIA and retain personnel to portray a more glossy, nicer image of the agency. And so they lend support and they lend advice, and they don't have the hardware that the DoD has. They can't give the filmmakers tanks and you know, but what they can do is they can offer on-set advice in order to make things more realistic, accurate, the CIA would say. And they can also grant the filmmakers access to the Langley headquarters, where they can film the CIA seal on the floor, and they can make it look more realistic by doing that. But the CIA, of course, what they do then is they have an advisor on set throughout the shoot, and they are free to suggest script changes, to kind of whisper things in the ear of various people in the production process, enact all sorts of changes. And what's slightly more sinister about the CIA's involvement in Hollywood is on a great deal of the projects that the CIA works on, there's no credit at all. Like the audience is completely unaware that the CIA has had any involvement in the film.
Yeah.
If you were to, so they do it kind of off the record.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go and watch Transformers, which was supported by the DoD, if you wait till the end credits and you wait till the end of the end credits, you will see a list of about a dozen names from the Department of Defense, with thanks to Phil Strub, Colonel such and such, Major such and such, General such and such. And you'll see that the Department of Defense has officially been involved in the film. You can go and look at who those people are. Most people don't wait till the end credits, or at least they don't read those things. So most people are completely unaware that Transformers had DoD involvement anyway. But you don't even have that option with CIA involvement, because in a great many of the instances of CIA involvement in Hollywood, it's kind of off the books. So, you know, CIA has been involved in all sorts of projects, major film projects, And the only reason we know about that is because the filmmakers themselves have spoken about it after the fact, but there's no reference to the CIA itself in the credits. So you're having this very secretive influence from an extremely influential government organization in what's supposed to be an entertainment product. And if that's not sinister, I don't know what is.
Yeah. It's creepy. It's unsettling because you don't know. You really have no. There's no transparency there at all.
No, there's not. I mean, sometimes they are credited, but I think that most of the time they're not. And then that's the official involvement. That's what goes on through the public liaison office, right? And then there's what I'm writing about at the moment is that there's ample evidence to suggest that there's a much deeper program of media manipulation that's under the CIA banner, and this is completely covert, completely illegal, and extremely pervasive.
What is the influence? What are they trying to do?
It's difficult to make sense of. Now, what I think is actually happening is, again, and this is based on documentation that's been released over the years and based on various testimonies that have come out. There isn't a complete picture. But, for example, you may have heard the name Chase Brandon in recent weeks.
Yeah.
With relation to these alleged Roswell disclosures that Brandon was making. Well, Brandon was the CIA's official liaison to the entertainment industry for 10 years. And he advised on dozens and dozens of film and TV projects. Sometimes openly, sometimes in a quieter way. Even the ones where he was openly advising, he wasn't subject to the guidelines, shall we say, as strict a guidelines as the DOD is subject to when it's involved in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great example where Chase Brandon, I don't know if you've heard of the TV series The Agency, which came out directly, it was actually filmed before 9/11 and it came out almost directly after 9/11, and it was a show that was entirely backed and sponsored by the CIA. It was actually the brainchild of the CIA, and it was a TV show that depicted the daily lives of the CIA, a drama series, a thriller.
Yeah.
And just a piece of propaganda, basically. But the advisor on that was Chase Brandon, and he spent a lot of time with the show's creator, a guy called Michael Frost Beckner. And Beckner has spoken to various people on the record over the years about how that series was shaped. And he told the film professor, Trisha Jenkins, who's an expert in CIA and propaganda, he told her that Chase Brandon actually phoned him up during the production of the show to suggest a plot line for the TV series that involved these highly advanced biometric identification technologies. And then when Michael Frost Beckner questioned Brandon about this, he said, well, is that really realistic? Do you really have that kind of technology? Brandon said, well, quote, put it in there anyway, whether we have it or not. Terrorists watch TV too. It'll scare them. So, and then another episode, Brandon actually suggested using a Predator drone, a CIA Predator drone, which is outfitted with Hellfire missiles, to kill a Pakistani general. And this was for an episode of the show. He said, why don't you have an episode featuring a Predator drone with Hellfire missiles and have it kill a Pakistani general? And he asked Beckner to quote, see how it plays out, see how you can make it work. 1 month after the show aired, the CIA assassinated a Pakistani general using Hellfire missiles from a Predator drone. And Beckner himself said, and I quote, I'm not a big conspiracy theorist, but there seems to have been a unique synergy there. And that wasn't the only instance of that happening. It happened on at least three or four other occasions throughout the shoot of the series where Brandon would suggest something, they'd film it, and then it would happen in real life. So it's kind of like using Hollywood as a test, really, to see. I mean, it seems crazy. It seems like a really strange way to go about operating, but apparently it seems to be a strategy tool for the CIA.
That's one
reason the CIA has for Hollywood. And then, of course, what the CIA is really doing in Hollywood is it's subtly manipulating hot button well, our perceptions of hot button national security issues. It's you know, the CIA's involvement in Hollywood today is really not so much geared towards recruitment and burnishing its own public image like
right.
the POD does. It is to subtly manipulate our perceptions of national security issues. And it's also to project a very carefully constructed image of America and of America's enemies as well, or its perceived enemies. And so today, the CIA does this, both with, its official media liaison program, and it also does it, more, well, covertly, shall we say, through this deeper program that it seems to have. And this program, by the way, when I talk about this deep program, this goes back to the 1950s. There were numerous examples throughout the 50s of the CIA acting covertly to influence the content of genre scripts. This didn't come out until decades later, so no one knew anything about it at the time, but there's been a great deal of academic research done on this now, and it shows quite clearly that the CIA did indeed infiltrate Hollywood very successfully, just as it infiltrated the mainstream news media from the 50s through to the 70s. You know, the... well, to give you an example, in 1953, you had an executive working at Paramount Studios called Luigi Liraci, and he was the head of censorship at Paramount. And in his job as head of censorship, well, obviously he wielded a great deal of influence. It wasn't known until decades later that Liraci was simultaneously a CIA operative, an asset. And he was answering directly to a CIA handler, and all of his letters to this handler have now been uncovered. And he was actively censoring and feeding scripts to kind of well, in line with the CIA's desires, really, with its ideological desires. And so you know, it was kind of very small stuff, really. It was you know, you had Liraci censoring scripts because there were problems, major problems, obviously, with race relations. Well, for most of America's history, but well, all of it, in fact, but especially, but especially in especially during the 50s and 60s. And what the CIA did was they felt that the Soviet Union might actually try to exploit America's really simmering racial tensions for propaganda purposes. And so what they did is they tried to depict a more harmonious image of race relations through genre films. And so what you had was well, Liraci describing in a letter to his CIA handler how he had managed to secure the agreement of Hollywood casting directors to subtly plant, and I quote, well-dressed Negroes into films, which included a dignified Negro butler who has lines indicating he is a free man. And that was in Sangre, the 1953 film. There's a golf club scene in the Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis comedy, The Caddy, The Caddy. And then you also had a scene in from the Western film in 1953 called Arrowhead. And there was a scene in that, as originally written, which questioned America's treatment of Apache, well, of Native American Indians, and especially Apaches, where you have a scene of an Apache tribe being forcibly shipped and tagged by the U.S. Army, and that was removed from the script at Liraci's bidding, basically. So you had these very kind of subtle changes being made to scripts throughout the Cold War, and these changes went on and on. And you've got to ask yourself, you know, if they're making changes on that kind of level, on that very detailed level, on relatively, I mean, not that obviously these aren't minor issues, but they're, but when it comes to, you know, depictions of colonial history, you know, what is the government also at this point tampering with UFO scripts? Bearing in mind that UFOs were at the time an extraordinarily serious national security issue.
Yeah.
I think the answer is absolutely they were tampering with UFO scripts. If they were tampering with scripts from every other genre, then you can bet that they were tampering with UFO scripts. It would be madness for them not to do so.
The mystery missile off the coast of California. Something or nothing.
I have a great fear that this is really something. The United States government has come out and said, and not quite definitively enough for me, said that this was probably That is their word, probably an airplane. Probably doesn't make it. We both watched the event. I think this could be aliens.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
And this is, it's very scary. The other thing, the missile went up. When does the missile come down? More importantly, where does the missile come down?
You would put in a call to President Blair Underwood. I knew that you would think
that's right.
that these beings were like
that's
94%
right.
human. Like,
whatever
no,
comes down
this
on
is
your
nothing.
Head.
This is a movie promo out of Southern California.
No.
That's all it is
no,
a marketing campaign. Reality? It is nada.
Absolutely nada. Wilbon's right.
Nothing.
It's falling off the table there. The missile's nothing. Wilbon gets the win. This was definitely something.
I hate this game.